This is episode 42 of the Fifth Estate podcast, Chris Arnotti and the Faces of Addiction. So this week's episode of the Fifth Estate is brought to you by our good friends at Blue Apron. Neil, you know about Blue Apron, right?
I do know a thing or two about Blue Apron, Jay, such as it's the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country.
That's great. Hey, did you know that its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone?
I had heard that before, actually. Did you know how they do that? They do it by supporting a more sustainable food system and setting the highest standards for ingredients. That's how they build a community of home chefs, Jay.
That is amazing. And the best thing, one of the best things about it is affordable. Less than $10 a person. They deliver that stuff with the recipes and the ingredients. You don't even really know how, you don't have to know how to cook. If you can follow directions, then you're good to go.
Absolutely. It's the easiest thing in the world. And, you know, it comes with step-by-step, easy-to-follow instructions. Again, pre-portioned ingredients. That means no waste. You're not going out hunting for various exotic ingredients. One of the other benefits, Jay, let me tell you about this. You can choose from a variety of new recipes each week, or you can let their culinary team surprise you. So you will never get bored.
No, and I've eaten some of this. I've eaten some of the meals and, you know, Swedish meatballs I've had. I've had fettuccine Alfredo with chicken. I mean, it's really good stuff.
Well, you know what's coming up on Blue Apron? It might be a good time for our listeners to get in on this. They've got spinach and fresh mozzarella pizza with olives, bell peppers, and ricotta salata.
Nice. And they've also got sweet and sour salmon with bok choy, carrot, and ginger fried rice. Now, here's the thing. If you just heard the word salmon and you're like, ugh, well, that's the beauty of Blue Apron is you don't have to have fish.
No, you don't have to. You can get the Parmesan-crusted chicken with creamy fettuccine and roasted broccoli instead.
Right. Or if you're, hey, I don't want meat. I don't want any kind of meat. I don't want fish. I don't want chicken. I want beef. I don't want pork. Baby broccoli and fontina paninis with hard-boiled egg and arugula salad.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
Something for everybody.
It really does have something for everybody. And if this sounds like something that you'd be interested in, dear listeners, let me just tell you this. You can check out this week's menu, and you can get your first three meals with Blue Apron for free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/fifth. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait.
Did you hear that, guys? Free. Three meals for free. You go to blueapron.com/fifth. F-I-F-T-H. blueapron.com/fifth. All right. It is time for another episode of the Fifth Estate podcast. My name is Jay Caruso. I am here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Dewing. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Jay. How are you?
I'm doing well. You know, we're only a few days away from opening day. I know that doesn't mean much to you, but for true patriotic Americans, baseball is starting in a few days, and that's a great thing.
Baseball is a wonderful pastime. I enjoy going to baseball games. I don't enjoy watching it on television, but I do enjoy going to the games.
Okay, so, well, at least there's that.
I, too, look forward to baseball season.
All right. Excellent, excellent. Okay, so before we get started here, as we do each week, we ask that you do us a solid. Go out to iTunes. If you like this podcast, go to iTunes. Leave us a review. Leave us a star rating. Also, tell your friends to subscribe. We appreciate more subscribers. And, you know, Neil, of course, always loves to get compliments.
I do. I like compliments. I like insults. I like any sort of attention, really. So give it to me now. In fact, one could say I have a bit of an addiction to attention.
And, true. Your addiction is harmless.
It is harmless, and unfortunately, not all addictions are as harmless and self-serving as my own. And today, our guest is someone who has spent the last couple of years doing a photography project, I suppose, documenting faces of addiction in a neighborhood in New York City.
Yes.
Jay, you had seen this, and
I saw it, and I follow our guest on Twitter, and I saw him tweet it out, and I saw it, and I said, okay, this sounds like a really interesting subject for us to kind of talk about and have him on. So Chris Arnotti is here with us. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So Chris, before we start talking about the project itself, why don't you kind of give us your background? And, you know, because I've been reading about you, and your background is a little unique, you know, in terms of where you started out and what you're doing now. So kind of go ahead and tell everybody about that.
Well, first I'd like to say I'm very excited about baseball as well. I'm a Cleveland Indians fan lifelong. So last year was very good, and I hope this year going forward is as good. I've basically had three careers. My first career was I was an academic. I got a PhD in particle physics, theoretical physics, from Johns Hopkins. That's why I like baseball partially. I was a stat head. In 1993, I got my PhD and I left physics and I went to Wall Street. And I, for 20 years, was a bond trader in New York City. Worked at Solomon Brothers. If you've ever read Liar's Poker or heard about Liar's Poker, that was kind of me, my life, for 20 years. And around 2000, I quit my job in 2012 because I was at that point getting involved in a personal project focused on addiction in a neighborhood of New York City, Hunts Point neighborhood, which is by many measures one of the poorest neighborhoods in the United States, the poorest in New York City, and it's in the South Bronx, and that personal project kind of took a life of its own and became what overtook me, and I ended up spending 3.5 years, 4 years in the Bronx, documenting, becoming friends with a group of homeless addicts, heroin, crack, and that kind of pivoted into what I'm kind of doing now, which is driving across the country and writing about addiction and poverty.
And for those who haven't seen the Faces of Addiction project, it is a series of starkly, in a way, beautiful photographs of people who are addicted to drugs, who are living on the street, who are not someone that you see typically front and center or portrayed in such a way. And it doesn't shrink away, I think, from some of the ugliness of their life, but in many cases, they're photographed, I think, with a good amount of dignity. It also, each photograph is accompanied by a short explanatory a story. So it's well worth checking out. So Chris, what gave you the idea to do this? What really brought you to this project in your life?
You know, it was a matter of, you know, I'm never quite sure why I ended up doing it, to be honest. I was working on Wall Street. I was unhappy with that life, becoming more and more dissatisfied with my Wall Street career. And I would go on these long walks through New York City, really long walks, like 20-mile walks. I call them terminus walks. I go to the end of a subway line and walk home above ground. And I just let my walks kind of have just whoever I met, I just talked to, and I started bringing my camera along. And I was going on a walk in the Bronx at the end of the 2 line, actually, I believe. And someone said, whatever you do, don't go to Hunts Point. And I'm like, well, of course I'm going to go to Hunts Point then, if you say that. When I got there, I just walked around and started talking to people. And what I saw And I kept going back and going back and going back. And what I saw was, you know, very, very, the people I met, their stories were very different from what we often see portrayed. You know, sometimes they overlapped and they looked like what the media generally shows. But, you know, these were prostitutes and these were heroin addicts and crack addicts. And, you know, they were opening up to me and letting me take their picture and listen to their stories. And I just felt some sort of, you know, I don't know what else to say other than, you know, just an urge to kind of share these stories. And I had never intended to turn it into a project. And so, you know, after the first time, I just found myself every weekend going back. And at the time I was working in Wall Street and I just kept going back and going back. And then, you know, I said what I wanted to do was, as I kind of got deeper in, I said what I wanted to do was kind of take conventional pictures of unconventional people and, you know, give them that dignity of a proper photograph instead of so many photographs you see of homeless people taken from a distance with a long lens and shows them sleeping in a box, you know. And I wanted the pictures to show them as individuals, their face looking at you, and for you to take that 5 seconds to look at the picture and see them as an individual and as a person, and then read their story beneath that picture, and, you know, their 3-paragraph story of how they got there, and you know, provide people with a different image than what we often see about addiction.
Well, Chris, yeah, that's really, really interesting. Explain, one of the things obviously is, you know, and I've lived in New York and worked in New York for a number of years, and I know and was there plenty of times, and you know, so homeless communities are somewhat clannish in a way, and, you know, very protective of themselves. So what did you do? How, you know, to try and get to gain the trust of people is very difficult. So what did you do in order to gain their trust? Because some of these, and when we'll put the link obviously in the show notes so people can go and look at the photos. Some of them are very intimate portraits. They're not taken from distance, like you said. They're not just somebody sleeping under a bunch of blankets or something like that. We're talking about kind of up close, intimate portraits with these people, and, you know, so it obviously they took a measure of trust for them to allow you to do that, so to let you kind of into that little world of theirs. So what did you do how did you go about that?
You know, I mean, again, it was, you know, it's there was never, when I look back, it was just becoming friends with them is really the, you know, I hadn't intended to turn it into a project. It was just, you know, I started talking to people and I got along with them and I kept going back and, you know, getting involved in their lives. And there's, and many of the people in the pictures are still my friends. You know, it's hard to maintain friendship with somebody who has a complicated life. But, you know, there's 5 or 6 of them that I still text and talk to on a semi-regular basis, and they're friends of mine now. But it was a matter of 2 things. One was going back, just going back all the time, you know, and kind of being willing just to show up, you know, when they said, hey, you know, I need you to take me to rehab. I need you to take me detox. I have to go see my kids, and just showing up with my van, you know, weekend after weekend, that then became night after night, that once I quit my job became pretty much every day. But also I have this relatively naive view that if you treat people with dignity, anybody, no matter who they are, you end up almost overwhelmingly, and it's very rarely has I ever had a bad problem where people treat you back with the same dignity. I always say that being scared of somebody is really presumptuous and relatively rude. If I just come up to somebody and, you know, just judge them by their looks that they're going to, you know, scam me or do something bad to me, that's pretty presumptuous. And I find that, you know, one of the things that I feel to this day, and I've certainly learned from my last 6 years involved in communities like this all across the countries, is what people who are in this position rarely see is someone who's willing to treat them as an equal. I mean, and just, you know, just go up and say, hey, let's talk about baseball, let's talk about Cleveland Indians, you know, or whatever their interest is. like you would anybody else. And I think that goes a long way to building trust. And, you know, and really trusting them, I mean, truly trusting them, when you look at the series, I mean, I spent, you know, there was a year there and off where, you know, I spent time in abandoned buildings at 1 a.m, you know, with people around, what people would call a crack house, at one, you know, crawling through, you know, over fences, going through small holes to get into abandoned buildings where people lived, you know, with people who have really spotty records, you know, if you look at them, and no one ever, and all that time, you know, here I was carrying a $7,000 camera, and no one ever harmed me. No one ever, you know, I had one incident, and that was tangential to the whole project. But through that entire time, no one ever stole something from me. Nobody has scammed me. You know, it was a matter of showing that proving just with time that I was well intended.
Go ahead, Neil.
Oh, well, I was just going to say that, Chris, I've had much the same experience when I've interacted with people on the streets, whether they're homeless or not, whether if they're just sort of living a little bit rough. Many, many times, what will happen is I'll sit down next to them on a bench, and they'll just strike up a conversation, and you treat them with the exact same level of respect that you treat anybody else. It's kind of, like you said, presumptuous to be afraid of someone that you just run into on the street. And my experience tracks, you know, very closely, you know, with yours. Obviously I haven't, done it as consistently as you have, but many of the time I've been out late at night and never had any sort of problem, met all sorts of people, and you look them in the eye, if you shake their hand, and just act friendly, you know, you're going to get back what you give out.
I think the other thing, you know, in terms of small things, it's like, you know, I ended up, you know, at the age, I started this project when I was 46 or so, and I ended up smoking menthols because I always had a pack of cigarettes to, you know, share a smoke with somebody I quit that, but take up smoking at the age of 46 after 46 years of not smoking, you know, and also, you know, McDonald's too, you know, like offering to buy a, you know, just sit down and buy a meal and not. You know, not run away afterwards. But, you know, it ended up getting much deeper than that, where I ended up doing quite a bit, getting very involved in these people's lives, and these people got very involved in my life. And it was hard. I mean, you know, when you get that close to somebody who has such complications and has that deep of an addiction, it can be very trying. To be that close, as many people know who listen to this, who have a family member who's involved in addiction, or has had a relative, or has had a congregant who's going through that, or a neighbor, it can also be very hard.
Now, indeed. Go ahead, Jay.
No, yeah. One of the things that I was reading about, Chris, was there was an article. I can't remember where I was reading it, but you were talking about the context of faith with a lot of the people that you came across, that, you know, for people who didn't have a lot, you said you would see a lot of Bibles and people who still kind of had hope despite their situation. So can you talk a little bit more about that as well?
Yeah. I mean, I came into this whole thing as an atheist, a lapsed Catholic and a lapsed Jew, I guess, given my family background. And you know, I was the science geek. I was the guy who was it the Dawkins guy who, you know, made fun of people who were religious. And this experience entirely changed me. I myself am not necessarily, I go to churches every weekend, but that's different because I don't follow a particular faith, you know, but I have huge respect for faith. And part of the reason was this project where here I was with people who had really had every reason to question, you know, I went going in saying, if anybody can't believe in God or doesn't believe in faith. It would be people who have such a rough life and who've had it, you know, who life has kicked so hard. And it was quite the opposite. These were people who, you know, what gave them hope, what provided them with moments of dignity, what they found hope, meaning in was almost always a combination of faith and, you know, rendered slightly different than maybe conventional, but it was Bibles, it was religious icons. And I also saw the work that church leaders were doing in the communities. You know, here I was. Look, I came at this thing as a, I said, I'm a very liberal person. I'm very background of a social, you know, as a Democrat and who was an atheist. And, you know, the people who were helping, really helping and providing help to the community I was working with was churches, you know, who they were the ones who were there at, you know, getting dirty like I was, you know, really putting in the time and really providing help to people who were in desperate needs and not judging them, and accepting them for their failures and accepting them for their path. And, you know, it was Franciscan nuns. It was, Pentecostal church groups who were really, and the way, and the people who, and, you know, and the faith really, really was important for them. Because, you know, when you tell somebody who has nothing in this life, if you're an atheist and you come into a community that feels like they have no physical power right now, nothing right now, and then tell them this is all they have, that's really insulting, you know, and saying, you know, so I kind of wrote a piece saying that I came away saying that, you know, atheism is kind of an intellectual luxury that, you know, that a lot of people have. And so it really changed my whole views on faith and how faith operates and the role faith plays in our communities.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, that's such a great point, Chris. One of the things that I've always heard is that the church is a hospital for sinners. It's not a museum for saints. You know, this perception that if you're all churched up, that you're going to look down on people who are in lower circumstances than yourself. It's the exact opposite. Essentially, these people are called to do works of mercy, and part of that work of mercy is also not treating these people like little lost pets, but meeting them where they are and dealing with their lives as they are, and essentially, again, you know, showing respect.
I think the phrase you said right there is really important. You know, not treating them like pets, just treating them like, you know, not trying to go in and, you know, one of the things that, you know, Pope Francis said when he was asked by a reporter, it was like, you know, when he first became Pope, was, you know, who are you? And he said, I am a sinner. And, you know, I think that understanding of fallibility and of we are all sinners. I'm certainly a sinner. I've made some very bad mistakes. I think we all have. I think, you know, you can try to. And I think, you know, spending the time I did and at the level I did with people in addiction, you really start recognizing that everybody is a sinner. And I think it puts it in perspective.
And just, you know, a question. I mean, did you ever meet anybody who you know, reveled in their addiction to various substances, who thought, oh, there's absolutely nothing wrong with this, or were people knew that they had a problem?
You know, I think the pathway into what I said, the addiction I saw was in the Bronx was a very hardcore. I mean, you're talking about. In my mind, it's a coping mechanism. It's ultimately about people who've been ejected. The series is called Faces of Addiction. The press turned it into Faces of Prostitution because, you know, the press always loves the word prostitute or sex worker.
Sure, yeah.
I always say, if I had to relabel it, it would be Faces of Trauma. You know, so many of the people involved had faced such awful traumas as a child and fled that. The drugs that came as a way to kind of both served as both, you know, a coping for the trauma, ability to deal with the trauma, or attempt to deal with the trauma, let me say that, but it also was a community. And I think, you know, nobody likes to be there. Nobody is proud of it. But they find comfort in the community. People won't find this hard to believe, but the crack house is actually a kind of community center in a really awful way. It's where people who've gone through really bad things can be with people who've also gone through with really bad things, who don't judge them, who can say, you went through this atrocious experience that's really hard for anybody else to understand, and sets you apart, you know. And then that feeling is, you know, they can find people who've, in an odd way, they become, you know, there's street families. I mean, they really do form the role of families. And so you get these relationships and these tight relationships that form on the street that, you know, in many cases, these people were ejected by their family, or they ejected themselves by the family because of abuse. And so the community, you know, the other homeless addicts on the street become their new family and serve the role of the family. So drugs becomes kind of this almost like the family dinner in a really absurd way. It becomes as much about the community as anything.
Yeah, one of the things you see with the stories as I was going through them, it's like you don't, and I haven't read all of them, but the ones that I have read, it's like you said, there's nobody here that started off in a well-to-do family that was, you know, going to college and had everything, and then descended into addiction, which does happen. But these are people that started with, you know, they started at the bottom in terms of, I'm trying not to be insulting here, but I say at the bottom, meaning that they came from parents who were already addicted to drugs from
I mean, you know, some of the
abusive
stories are
parents.
Just,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, some of the stories are just, you know, mind blowing. And, you know, you wonder, you know, for instance, Takesha, she was, Takesha's, I'm still friends with her. She was the first one I met. You know, there's a monastery in Hunts Point, believe it or not. It's been there since 1870, the Corpus Christi Monastery. And she was, she is a prostitute under the gates of the monastery. I mean, you couldn't get any more cliched. And, you know, and when I talked to her, she was one of the first I became friends with and got very close with. And, you know, her mother was a crack addict who was a prostitute who started working, worked shifts with, you know, put Patricia out on the street at the age of 13 or 14, you know, and here she is 42. And how, you know, you start with that beginning, it's really, really hard to even comprehend a life of a white picket fence with, you know, watching Friends on TV or whatever show you want to watch on TV. That other lifestyle is just really hard to comprehend. It's just so distant. And, you know, she's been through so much in her life that, you know, it's really hard to even for me now, after 4 years of being close to her, to even comprehend what, you know, it's very hard for me to tell her what to do, you know, given that our experiences are just so different. We come at things from such a different place.
Is there anybody that you met when you were through these years who escaped?
No,
it got clean.
No. And, you know, at some point I wrote a piece, you know, after 2 years of this, saying that I kept looking for, you know, I kept looking for a happy ending. And the story was the lack of a happy ending. Mm. You know, almost everybody who I met initially, is either in jail now, dead, or, you know, still doing this, still kind of balancing between jail, rehab, and the streets. You know, there's one person who I'm hopeful of. I think things are going well. I mean, there's two people who got it together a little bit better. I mean, in terms of how we would say got it together, you know, one of my friends now has been clean for 15 months, finished the treatment, and I have hope, you know, but we'll see. Maybe a happy ending, maybe. But I kind of learned to stop expecting that, you know, and just judge and treat it as, you know, what's the best that we can do to, you know, to give them, you know, harm reduction? What's the best, you know, to, you know, I can do to help you have dignity and be respected?
So, Chris, what do you hope that people who view the project, what do you hope that they take away from it?
You know, I think I always say that, look, when we build narratives that work for us. And one of the narratives we successful people, like, you know, varying levels of success, but somebody who isn't an addict, one of the narratives I believe we build is that if somebody's an addict, they deserve it. It's because of some atavistic failing. They're weak, they're lazy, they're dumb, you know, whatever you want to add in there. And that's a really easy narrative to build if you don't take the time to talk to people who are actually stuck in that cycle. When you actually take the time to read the stories of people or get to know them, you realize that there's a lot more going on. There's context. There's a lot more complex story. There are people who are just as bright as me and you, just as smart, just as hardworking, you know, who have skill sets. Just like in aggregate, the population of addicts has the same skill sets as the population of people who aren't addicted, but they came from very different backgrounds and very different experiences. And I think, you know, if you're forced to, you know, the idea was to look at the pictures, to see them as humans, and then read the stories to fill in and realize that the narrative that an addict deserves it, is wrong, and the reality is much more complex than that. And that's an uncomfortable thing to be in, because when you start realizing that, I think, you know, certainly in my case, it was a recognition that all I had, and I have quite a bit. I've been very fortunate in my life. I've made a lot of mistakes, but here I am, and I'm doing well. That my situation is as much about luck and as about having been born into, you know, a household with two parents who loved me, who had time to dedicate to raising me and gave me the things I wanted, and neighbors who supported me, and a church that supported me, and all those things. And that was, for some people, they don't have that. And maybe that's why they are where they are.
It's very much a there but for the grace of God, go I kind of situation.
Yeah, you know, it's the old look, you know, it's just a different form of asking people. Just walk, you know, just imagine being someone else's shoes. Just put yourself in someone else's shoes. Walk a mile in their shoes just for a little bit before you cast judgment, before you. And I think that's true in kind of what I try to do in my work going forward and everything I do, reporting from different communities across the country, is just give context. Just before you say a group of people is dumb, before you say a group of people is lazy, before you say a group of people are racist, before you say a group of people are whatever, Just take the time, imagine being in their shoes and walk a mile in their shoes and understand the situation they're in. And I find that when you do that, you know, you end up being, you know, you kind of going back to the religious thing where we're all sinners. We're all equal in that sense. We all face, you know, have problems. We all make mistakes and we all try our best in aggregate.
That is something definitely to keep in mind. Switching gears a little bit here, Chris, let's talk about, because, you know, like I said, when I first saw this, when I first clicked on the link as a photographer myself, I just said, wow, these are excellent photographs. These are not just snapshots or anything like that. I mean, you could almost make the case that, you know, if people didn't know, you could say it was an ad campaign in certain aspects for, you know, for an anti-drug campaign or something like that, because you took these actors or actresses and made them look, you know, this way. But the photos are real and of real people. But clearly you have, you know, when you started this, you already had a background in photography. At least that's my guess based upon what you've done.
Right.
So, you know, let's talk a little bit about, you know, how did you get these photographs? What kind of equipment, and what got you into doing photography to begin with, to know that this was something you might want to try out?
I mean, I was always a photo geek as a kid. I, you know, in grad school in physics, I built a camera. So I was, you know, I played around with pinhole cameras when I was, you know, I was a real photo geek. But I gave up photography because of my job and because of raising kids, and I just didn't have the time.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until like 2010, I just picked up a camera again, a Nikon D810, so a pro camera, a digital camera. And, you know, I'd been going on these walks, and I just want to kind of capture some of the people I met. And you know, capture behind, because I was writing little stories of my walks and people I met, just kind of blogging it. And I wanted to capture the stories of the people I met and the images of them. So I started taking pictures. But I made an intention artistically to keep it simple. And there was also the simple, you know, the reality of, look, I would go into a crack house. Like, I mean, I was crawling through tunnels that, you know, I'm 6'2 and 210, so getting through some of these tunnels was really tough. I just had to keep it light. And so all I had is just a simple camera, no light. You know, so most of the pictures in the crack houses are taken with, you know, someone might have a phone that has a spotlight sometimes, or candlelight. But also, you know, like I said, always allowing a dignified portrait as the person wants to have their picture taken. And that meant, you know, showing them the picture afterwards, and if they didn't like it, deleting it. But also, you know, I think I'm very fortunate that I didn't go to art school, because I think I would have gotten too clever and try to make the pictures somehow more complicated.
Right.
I just wanted to keep it simple and do dignified portraits of people who, you know, who don't generally get the chance to get dignified portraits. You know, just again, keep it very, very simple, because a lot of equipment scares people. It just changes the dynamic, and it no longer becomes, you know, it just turns into something else. So if I even ever thought about bringing lights in, it would have messed everything up.
Okay, so you just basically you had your camera and that was it, and
that's it.
And so
for a while I had a little LED box that was about the size of, I don't know, my hand.
Okay.
That sometimes I lit a few pictures near the end, but in general, 95%, 96% of the pictures are taken without any light. I mean, sometimes I use my car headlights.
Okay.
Because the neighborhood neighborhood's pretty desolate. It's mostly it's kind of auto body shops and things like, and junkyards, and they close up at night. So, you know, I could just park my car in the middle of the street and just shine it on somebody. But you know, the technique has always been in my mind is just minimize gear. Because it gets in the way of everything.
Right.
It gets in the way of me as a photographer. I can't say to somebody, oh, you know, do you mind redoing that again when in your middle of a crack house and people are shooting up around you? You got to kind of just work with what you got.
Right. Yeah. From an artist's point of view, you know, and this is one of the reasons why I wanted to cover this, is if anybody who's listening has ever wanted to do any kind of documentary work or anything like that, that you don't need a ton of equipment to be able to do it, to tell the stories of people, regardless of what it is, whether it's addiction or, you know, it's, you know, your daughter's dance recital or something like that. So, I think that's important. And so just to kind of talk a little bit more about your interactions with people, it's like, you know, you could sit there and befriend somebody and talk to them and get to know them a little bit, but the moment you put a camera up to your face, people have a tendency to change immediately. You know, they know a camera's on them, and so their face changes and their body language changes and everything like that. And did you have that kind of experience, or because, you know, they were just so comfortable being who they were that it didn't matter? Or did you have to kind of, I know you said, oh, I don't want to sit there and take another pose, but were you ever had to tell anybody, hey, just relax a little bit? Or were you just talking and then start shooting?
That I always say, regardless of what, you know, I mean this both literally and figuratively. I can't say that word, figuratively. My advice I always give to anybody taking pictures is always get on the level of your subject. you're taking a picture of a child, get on the floor and, you know, get at their, be their height. If you're taking, you know, and that's true, you know, I use that in a metaphorical sense, in crack houses as well, be on their level. You know, if you end up, you know, if you take it from a weird angle, or if you take it from a weird angle, you know, it's just going to mess things up. You know, you shoot a kid, picture of a kid looking down at them and they're looking up at you, it just looks weird. So getting on their level, and that meant, you know, crawling through whatever. And you know, once you prove that you're just part of the process, the team, then people relax. The other thing, though, is I found is the minute video gets involved, all bets are off. And it, the few times I try to do small videos, it just messed everything up.
Do people just start performing?
People got scared. People perform. It just entirely changes it. And so people always ask, like, why do you have no video? It's just like, because it just messed up the whole dynamic. And I think, you know, on the streets, and especially amongst poor people, they know two things. They know, you know, so in terms of social media, they know YouTube, and then you know Facebook, you know. And so there, I was working along with a lot of people. You know, remember, a lot of people I'm spending time with, a lot of what we were doing was officially illegal activity. I'm in crack houses. I'm trespassing. I'm in an abandoned building. I'm around drug dealers. I'm with people buying drugs. I'm with people shooting up drugs. So, you know, the minute there's a video, they're like, oh no, man, you're not putting that on YouTube, are you? And so it just changes the whole dynamic. You know, it may be true for other projects where you can use video, but for this one, it just wasn't right.
Well, and I think especially for what you were doing, video would have very much, I think, cheapened it, because what you were able to capture in these shots, I think, is that moment, you know, the moment where they're, you know, preoccupied with the drugs, or they're looking at you, and maybe there's just the hint of a smile on their face before they actually smile. And you capture something in that. You capture something in that moment that video would not just not be capable of doing. So they really are just amazing portraits of these people.
Well, thank you for that. I mean, it's, you know, I think that everybody wants to do video. I understand the urge to do it, but I think portraits coupled with writing can accomplish a lot in a different way than video does. And I think, you know, that's why I've stuck with that. It forces us to, again, it forces video. There's too much going on, and you sometimes stop. You don't look at the person because, you know, you look at the cat in the background, or you hear the sound in the background, or whatever. And, you know, the thing about portraits is it really does force you to look at a person and think about that.
Yeah, and I think Neil made a great point about photography, and it captures just a specific moment in time. To give people a more, you know, more example they may recognize is the photo of Muhammad Ali standing over Sonny Liston, you know, with his arm pumped. If you see the video of that, you almost miss it because it's moving so quickly. And so that one little moment in time is captured forever, and I think that's what makes your photos such – so dynamic and so beautiful in a way, you know, that is beautifully haunting is the way I kind of thought about it, because you have some of these images where you have these people who struggle, who have this struggle, but at the same time, there's these intimate moments, especially with the couples, where there's, you know, you could see they truly love each other, and, you know, you're just capturing them in this little space of time that, you know, just kind of shows beyond, you know, the surface, you know, that they're human beings and they're people like the rest of us. So I think that's what I think you just did an absolutely terrific job with this. And
I mean, at its core, photography is about just stopping things and right. And giving you the opportunity to, you know, just slow stuff down.
Yeah.
And our lives are just so, I mean, we're so overwhelmed with so much these days that, you know,
it allows you to reflect.
Exactly. It gives you a kind of a chance to stop. And, you know, even if it's only 5 seconds, just, you know, we rarely look at people and just contemplate them for 5 seconds.
Right. Certainly do. So Chris, do you have like anything else going on? I mean, are you in the middle of any other kind of projects right now that you're doing?
You know, I've kind of pivoted this into, I put 200,000 miles of my car, 175,000 miles of my car, driving across the country, writing about, originally was writing about addiction across the United States, not just Hunts Point. And I was going to different communities, but that ended up pivoting me into writing about politics, actually, about, you know, I said, I was one of the first people to point out that kind of the correlate, you know, the heroin epidemic that's hitting so much of Appalachia, and the Rust Belt, and that's sweeping across America in a really ugly way. And I've kind of been involved in it and kind of documenting that and writing about how, you know, I always say is when I go to different communities all across the country now, places that people don't usually visit, spend a week there, 2 weeks there, 10 days, 5 days. And kind of do this a similar thing to what I did in the Bronx in these places. And what I always say is when I where in these communities I see hope leaving, I see drugs entering. And that's true in places, you know, like Portsmouth, Ohio, or Prestonburg, Kentucky, Binghamton, New York, you know, El Paso, Texas. You know, I could just, you know, there's too many communities in this country at this point that are you know, seeing a lot of what's going on in Hunts Point, or has gone on in Hunts Point for a long time, in terms of drugs taking over a lot of the places.
And part
and
of
it's
it, part
easy
of,
to
oh,
go
go
ahead,
ahead.
Jay.
No, I was gonna say part of it too is the heroin, from what I understand, is pretty cheap. You know, that it's kind of made a comeback because of the fact that marijuana is, and, you know, the states are getting so into it that it's become more expensive, and that cocaine is not, you know, the drug of choice anymore. That and heroin, because it started with the opioids in the 90s with, you know, OxyContin and stuff like that, and so now. And correct me if I'm wrong, but this is what I've read, is that, you know, the drug is it's very inexpensive, and it's part of the reason why it's made such a it's doing such damage to these neighborhoods, like you say.
You know, heroin, you know, I wrote a piece, and I said it's a little glib statement, but there's a lot, you know, it's much more complicated than that. But I always say that drugs are popular because drugs work. You know, and heroin in particular is, you know, I've never done heroin. I don't intend to ever do heroin. I would urge anybody listening to this to never, ever, ever, ever try heroin. It's an awful drug, or any of the opioids, because it really is, relative to others, very addictive. But you know, for people who are in a lot of pain, emotional pain, and physical pain, they're very effective in terms of kind of acting as a numbing agent. And what I've seen in many of these communities I go to, there's a lot of pain in these communities, and I kind of feel like, you know, ultimately I always say addiction is a demand issue, not a supply issue. How it gets rendered, how what drug people ends up using is about supply. But in aggregate, it's my own personal opinion. I'm in the minority on this, that I feel that if you cut off the supply of heroin tomorrow, people would be using something else. The addicts are stunningly creative and hardworking about being able to fulfill their need, their desire. They're very creative about getting, informing, and creating things to act as a drug. So I feel like ultimately all what we're seeing across the country is about people wanting drugs ultimately. And you know, it just so happens, because of the availability of pills and the cheapness of heroin, that's the way it's playing out. But I would suggest that if that wasn't the case, if you were to take all those away, it would be something else. It'd be meth. It would be, you know,
Yeah.
glue. It would be something. It's just, there's just so many pain in these. You know, the pain I saw in Hunts Point, in terms of people who face this awful traumas, is I see it across the country now. It may not come from domestic violence. It may not come from being sexually abused in every case, but it comes from growing up and feeling humiliated, and or feeling just not feeling like you fit in, not feeling like you're valued. And that's what I see. You know, I like I said, I put on roughly 175,000 miles on my car driving across the United States in the last 2 years, and I've seen a lot of that. A lot of people just who really feel like nobody cares about them, and one, you know, how they define it.
Well, and Chris, I think that was one of the things that kind of blindsided a lot of the political commentators, both the right and the left, in 2016, was that there are groups of people who feel apart from what is considered to be society, to, you know, the proper way to organize society. And you know, every cultural message sort of reinforces that outsider status, that sort of rejection. And it's no wonder that people you know, take that to heart, internalize it, and you know, and engage in self-destructive behaviors. I think one of the real benefits of your projects is that it gets people to think, well, maybe I shouldn't assume anything. Maybe I should just go talk to people. Maybe I should listen to what they tell me instead of waiting for them to finish so that I can start talking again. And so I think it brings a tremendous amount of value. Do you have any plans for this project? Are you going to collect it into a book? Going to keep it on the web for now, or
for the time being, I'm probably going to end up turning it in, this and my work across the country, into some form of book. I'm not sure when. I feel like there's, in terms of seeing it across the United States, I feel like there's still, I haven't been to the West Coast, and I need to do that. I kind of said I was going to visit 30 communities across the country. I mean, really visit them, really spend time in them. And I kind of done about 25 now. And, you know, just kind of slightly pivoting to what's going on today in the politics is, or, you know, talking about the heroin epidemic that's across the country is, in a few days, I'll be going back to Portsmouth, Ohio. It's a small town in South Ohio, right on the Ohio-Kentucky border, on the Ohio River. I think it's like 50,000 people, Portsmouth. And it was kind of shocking because the drug scene I saw there reminded me a lot of what I saw in the Hunts Point. The kind of level of dysfunction, the level of how much drugs have gone into the fabric of society. And it really was shocking. I mean, there was prostitution, there was open air streetwalkers, sex workers, you know, in this blue collar white town in Southern Ohio. There was people ODing in the McDonald's. There was people born, you know, I met a girl, 19 years old, who was born to a mother who's now dead. Her dad's in jail. Her mother was an addict. Her mother OD'd about 2 years ago, but she was taken away from her mother and father, raised by her grandmother. Her mother came back into her life and started using heroin with her at 13. Mm. So this is a young white girl. And you know, that the kind of parallels to what I saw in the Bronx with Takesha. I mean, she's not doing sex work. But there's others, you know, there's parts of Portsmouth where there's women walking on the streets who are, you know, charging money to get high. So it's really, I think it's really frustrating to me to see that what's happening in the South Bronx, you know, people look at it and say, well, that's an anomaly, but no, it's happening now in places across the country and towns like Portsmouth, which once was this, you know, place that, you know, had, you know, it wasn't known for things like this, you know, 3 years ago. So, I think there's more work to be done in this project in terms of showing it's not just in kind of a poor Hispanic community in the South Bronx. It's kind of everywhere now. And I think it, at least in my opinion, that says something very, very bad about the way we're kind of our society as it's structured right now, that this is happening to this level. You know, to a girl in Portsmouth at the age of 19 is born into this situation where, you know, that something I see in the South Bronx.
It's heartbreaking, and you've really shone a light onto it. We've been talking with Chris Arnotti, who is the artist behind Faces of Addiction, a four-year project focused on the stories of addicts in the Hunts Point neighborhood. Chris, thank you so much for sharing this with us and giving us your perspective on these issues.
And thanks for having me. And to anybody else out there who's a Cleveland Indian fan, this year we'll win.
Yeah, you know, I was gonna sit there and get into a whole big thing about the conversations you had with people in the Bronx about the Cleveland Indians
with Yankee Stadium looming. That must be awkward sometimes.
Manny Ramirez, who played for the Indians, is a hero in the Bronx.
Well, Chris, we do like to try to go out on a bit of a lighter note. And this is where we spring our one gotcha question on you. And we do this to all our guests. We don't tell you ahead of time what the gotcha question is going to be. But we just go ahead and lay it on you and see how you react. So are you ready?
Yeah.
All right. Chris, is the show Seinfeld overrated?
In my opinion, hell yes.
Oh, really? A New Yorker saying this?
I'm in the way minority. You found somebody who's like 10 standard deviations. I mean, you found the person who doesn't like Seinfeld.
I think we may be the only two.
I don't get it.
You've made Neil very happy.
I just don't get the show, and I'm fully aware that I'm in a massive minority on that case, but. When I find somebody who also shares the, I'm not at the level of dislike, I'm close, who just doesn't get Seinfeld, I find it annoying. And when I find someone else who finds it annoying, I become immediate friends.
For me, it's just like, I get it. Okay, people enjoy the show, but is it that good? I don't think so.
Neil's enjoying this way too much.
So this is an unexpected pleasure, I must say.
You know, I don't attack people who like it. I'm
no,
you know,
of course not.
I don't judge if people like it. I just learn to not talk about it.
If only they would let us not talk about it. So many references to the show. Ugh, it's tough to navigate. But Chris, thank you so much for the very insightful talk, and also for being absolutely 100% correct about Seinfeld.
Thank you for having me.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Chris. And I'm Jay Caruso for Neil Dewing. We will see you next time here on The Fifth Estate.